This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. In the crazy time that we are living in, I know some of you might be experiencing some anxiety, some fear, maybe even related to deconversion and deconstruction. This might be the first time that you are experiencing tragedy or anxiety without having the sense of the presence of a God. I wish I had simple answers. I don't. I don't think there's much that I can add beyond what the scientists are saying. Listen to the epidemiologists and not the politicians. The secular grace thought of the week is this, that you're no longer obligated to defend God on this. The question of why, although it may not have an answer, you don't need to try to explain how this is somehow working together for the good. To quote Patton Oswalt's wife, who died of cancer, it is all chaos. All we can do is be kind to one another. Love each other through this process. Reach out to people who you know are hurting from the lack of contact. Virtually, do so in a safe manner with social distancing, but be good to people. On to today's show. My guest today is Sarah. Sarah was one of the co-contributing authors to the book Still Unbelievable, the response to Justin Brierley's unbelievable book. Sarah participates in the Skeptics and Seekers podcast, as well as the forums for the Unbelievable podcast. Sarah has a unique blend of being a down-to-earth person, but with an edge of intellectual rigor that is amazing. I think you're really going to enjoy her story. Here's my conversation with Sarah. Sarah, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. So, Sarah, yeah, exactly. I'm alive. I suppose we should mention we are recording on March 26th. This is the middle of the pandemic, so we may or may not refer to that in the conversation, but that's definitely on our minds. And I just recently met you, Sarah. We were on a episode of Skeptics and Seekers with David Johnson, and I loved your story and your approach, and I wanted to ask you to come on the show and just tell your story from beginning to end. So thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. We had a lot of fun doing the last chat, so I'm looking forward to this one.
Absolutely. So I like to just begin with the beginning. What was your faith tradition, and what was it like for you growing up in that tradition?
Yeah, so I was, I'd say, factory set on the Christian side of things from just early on. My parents are Christians. My grandparents are Christians on both sides. My mum's French, so I had French grandparents, and my dad's English, so I've got some English grandparents as well. So all of them were kind of Protestant, fairly mainstreamy type of things in the views. And nothing struck me as particularly strange, but then nothing would if you just brought up in it. So I had actually quite a wide exposure, I would have thought, to a reasonable amount of different faiths. I had, we'd been to Methodists and Baptists and Église Réformée in France. We went to Salvation Army at a time when we used to visit people in France. We had Anglicans, we had, and then quite a long time in the Charismatic movement. I'd seen churches in the UK because we visited lots of friends, spent some time in the States with Tony Campolo's organization.
Oh, wow.
I think people may know of Bart Campolo. Yeah. So I worked in Philadelphia for a few months, and I'd been to, you know, churches and camps in France as well, kind of, you know, Bible camps and things like that. So I think I had a fairly good understanding of what was out there. And my mum and dad are super sociable. They've looked, they've lived in different places in the world as well. They lived in the States for a while. And so they had a lot of friends, Hindus, Muslims, anything, you know, they didn't discriminate. They loved different cultures and that sort of thing. We had people from all over the world visit us all the time. My mum, if she could get her hands on a Messianic Jew, she was as happy as anything. She loved a Messianic Jew. So I think we even hosted Shabbat one time at our house for people to learn. You know, so we were really quite open. And I would say my parents are quite, you know, quite good in that respect. So, but the main memories was in a Baptist church, sort of 7, 8, 9 years old. The church split, and then we moved into this charismatic church, which was from the States, the Barney Coombs and Bob, I keep wanting to say Bob Mumford and Sons, but it's not quite him. Bob Mumford, the sort of, they came from the States. I don't know whether you're familiar with that branch.
I'm not.
No? Okay. But it was all part of the shepherding movement and that side of things that were really kind of big in the 70s and 80s. So after a church bit, we went there. As far as I was concerned, it was fantastic. There was a few kids to play with. But my mum and dad, basically, we started a kind of a weird 10 years in the cult sort of thing, or eight to 10 years, where it was a quite heavy shepherding movement with, you know, everybody had a shepherd, everybody had somebody to talk to. And they were, basically, it was amateur counseling, really.
Right.
People were totally not equipped to do this. So they would be telling people who had flown violent relationships to, you know, discipline their children physically with a wooden spoon. Or my dad was told that his work needed to, you know, he needed to leave his work because he couldn't spend enough time within the cult doing.
Oh, wow.
My mum was told to renounce her Frenchness, whatever that even means. So there was kind of some weird thing going on there. And but not, you know, as a child, it wasn't, I was mostly protected from this lunacy. The church set up its own school, so a lot of people went there. My sister and I were about the only ones who didn't. We just went to a normal state school, and I am forever happy about that because it was a very strange school. So yeah, that was mostly the kind of background. My parents started questioning, would just sort of ask a few things there, and immediately they were ostracized. They were told not, people weren't meant to mix with them too much, that we were a bit of a danger, that we were just for asking questions and just maybe saying, look, should we talk about, you know, talk about this? Or so yeah, they were very much pushed to the side. Other people were promoted in the church, that kind of thing. It was really bit like a cult.
Yeah.
And they were told they're out the kingdom. And so after a while, I think they just thought, I think we've had enough of this. This isn't really the family that it's advertised as being.
Right. Yeah.
So they kind of ran away literally. We weren't at that stage.
And you didn't have to escape. Yes.
No, we didn't have to leave in the middle of the night. We just kind of, they went around and told everyone they were leaving. So it was all very nicely done. But and then they just sought sanctuary in the Anglican church, which kind of leaves you alone and just has liturgy and readings and things like that. So yeah. They're much happier in that church. They still attend church now. They live in Austria and go to an international church there.
Okay.
So I was about 15, 16. I carried on going to the weirdo cult thing, but mostly because I fancied a boy there who is now my husband. So
that'll get you every time.
Exactly. So so we met when we were about 10 in this weird setting.
Wow.
Okay. Obviously he wasn't ever interested in me at that age. It was just it wasn't until I was about 17, 18 that we got together.
Yeah.
And are still together after quite a number of years now. So it wasn't all bad. Some good things came out of it. So I mean, I believed it all. It was the way the world was set up. There was nothing to question. I never questioned the fact that whether there was a God or not. The story made sense. We were broken in our nature. We were needing, you know, we've transgressed a divine being, so we probably do deserve to be punished in some way. And yeah, it all just made sense. So went to university there. I attended a Baptist church. After that, when we got married, which let's face it, all evangelicals get married a little bit too young. We all know why. And as I say, I've just got friends now that I've heard of split up who got married way too young,
right?
Because that, you couldn't obviously shack up together or anything like that. So, and they're getting divorced now. So, you know, it's not great. But fortunately, it's worked out. Fortunately, even though we're very different people now, and he's deconverted with me, as it were. So we're still on the same page. Then we lived in Oxfordshire, and Oxford itself, for a good number of years, and we attended a Vineyard church there, which again is the kind of the charismatic.
Yeah.
Movement there. So we were there when the whole Toronto blessing kind of broke out, and you know, the whole dog barking at the front and
yes,
and I always remember sort of being hanging around the back thinking, I really don't feel very comfortable with this stuff. But okay, if you're telling me it's the Holy Spirit, then knock yourselves out, which is what seems to be happening. They're all laying on the
Literally,
ground. And,
yes.
yeah,
Yes.
I had a bit of that myself. I did a falling over at one point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we attended that. But I suppose what sparked it off, I had some sort of little virus thing, corona,
yeah.
just to be topical, and ended up with some sort of post-viral chronic fatigue thing, which hung around for 5 years. So it was quite a long time.
Oh, wow.
Especially
okay.
when you're in your 20s. Yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, there's obviously worse things in life, but it's pretty tough when you're reduced to, you know, 50%, 40% of what you could do before. So I had for a good 5 years to sit around and think a lot and read, and obviously pressed into God and decided to use it to, learn more about God, draw close to Him, and carried on to attending church. But then that gets really hard in a charismatic setting when you're ill. They don't do illness very well.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. They don't do suffering very well. They're not used to the long, dark nights of the soul, which if you start moving away from it and looking at other writings and things, you realize other Christians have gone through those things, that it's very much a candy machine. You pray, you put the money in, out pops your blessing and healing, and God's intimately tinkering with your life all the time in the charismatic setting. So,
Let me pause you real quick before we, it sounds like we're transitioning to more of the doubts. I want to just focus still on your religious experience as well. I mean, that's just a fascinating story, going from a very heavy shepherding movement to a stop over an Anglican church to a Baptist, which I'm assuming was the British kind of flavor of Baptist.
Yeah, not Southern Baptist. It's more like Episcopalian type kind of.
Okay.
It's pretty moderate. They clap a bit and maybe have an overhead projector.
Yeah. an overhead projector is wild. Okay.
Yeah, with the slides. It's all updated now. You can tell the age of all of this.
And then moving on to Vineyard. So the question I want to ask is, that's quite a broad spectrum of practice, as it were, or experience. And even you mentioned being slightly uncomfortable when you got to the more charismatic Vineyard environment. Did any of that strike you as odd, that all of these people are Christians and yet there's quite a wild disparity in practice?
Well, I think from, the whole charismatic thing, I kind of was down with that. I was like, okay, the Holy Spirit, you expect to see some stuff, you expect to see some healing, some kind of tongue speaking. That all made sense. And we did kind of look down in pity at the churches that were considered, and I'm air quoting, dead churches, you know, that only sang hymns and didn't lay hands on people. And so we just thought they were kind of had a subpar version, that they weren't having the happy clappy stuff that we were.
It's not full gospel.
Yeah, exactly. But in terms of doctrine and stuff, I found them fairly homogenous. I didn't find too much difference between them. You just knew that. No, I mean, I was kind of fairly open. I even would have accepted a good Catholic in those days, and thought, anybody can be a Christian. And so, I mean, again, I've got my parents to thank for that. They did open my eyes to a bit of a wider variety than maybe just, you know, a Southern Baptist experience if you're in the States and that's all you've ever known.
Yeah.
So I didn't struggle too much with Muslims going to hell or anything like that. I thought if their heart was right, that they would make it as well. And not too bad. And I suppose, most churches we visited, they preach the same type of thing, a lot about the Gospels, really, and Jesus, and how to live your life and practical ways of applying it. There's very little in any of all of this experience of kind of the historical or the Jewish traditions or the more academic side of it. I mean, very, really, really lacking. I remember writing down a date once and going, oh, wow, we can actually map this to history. You know, King David was X date, and thinking, oh, that's sort of, it's a bit interesting, but I don't know anything about it. But I think I understood the main, and it was for the most part, a fairly healthy message. It wasn't, you're all going to burn and Calvinistic or anything like that. It was pretty much Jesus loves you. He's kind of going to, but you did have to, you know, repent a bit. There's a bit of repenting needed.
Yes.
And committing yourself. They're very obsessed in that movement, aren't they, with the moment of conversion. So you kind of, when you're in the in your teen years, you convert almost weekly because so much happens in a week of a teenager that you're kind of like, I don't think I did it quite right last week. So so I was repenting and setting myself back like an Ecto sketch, you know, one of those things, cleaning the slate over and over again.
That is very common. I hear that from many deconversion stories, particularly traditions that focus on a born again experience or something of that nature, that is just over and over and over again, that clearly I must not have done it right the previous 35 times, you know, I've got to do it again this week.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I did also think, well, I didn't really have that a major point. I just grew up, you know, believing it. At seven, I made some sort of commitment about opening up my heart and letting Jesus in, whatever that means to a seven-year-old. But yeah, and then I had a few doubts as a teenager, but nothing too serious, and university as well. In the UK, we're quite secular, so being a Christian is very much you're the odd one out. So I kept it very under wraps. I kept it really low key. I was the weirdo if you know, at school, or I was the weirdo at uni if I kind of said too much about, if anybody says too much about it, you would be seen as a bit of an outlier. So not like in the States, where I know it's the other way around in certain areas, which must be tough for people. So yeah, and the UK, it's not very in your face, or even though we have the Church of England, which is still linked to the government and enjoys certain privileges, it's weirdly not as much as you see in the States. We don't have kind of prayer breakfasts and it is pretty low key and quite a multicultural society as well, so we have to be tolerant of Muslims and other faiths quite a lot as well. So
I do think that the United States is on that trajectory. You know, we saw in the 20th century the secularization of Europe and the UK. You know, very much feels that since the advent of the internet that the US is, you know, headed that direction, right? One of the things that falls out from that I find interesting is something that you kind of hinted at, that in a more secularized society, the people who do have faith really hold together. There's a almost more of a bonding that takes place because you are the odd person out.
I guess there's a big difference between East, West Coast and Middle Bible Belt kind of area, isn't there? I mean, I had no idea.
You hit it on the head there, that it depends on where you live in the States. So that the coasts tend to be much more liberal, much more secularized. And if you're in a city, a big city, the same thing is true. But rural or the middle of the country, very religious. That's just assumed. It is assumed that you are a Christian.
Yeah, that was a big eye-opener. I didn't realize that, you do not assume in the UK that anybody's religious. It's very much like, really? When I deconstructed and told my friends, actually, I've deconstructed, they're like, well, we never even knew you were a Christian. That's really a stab in the heart. It was supposed to be all shiny and light, but okay. Yeah, and well, we always saw the States as, you know, more or less the pit of hell, because you'd have all your stuff coming over to the UK and, you know, all the kind of horror movies and stuff. And we were like, oh, they're degenerate culture over there. So, but then you realize there is definitely this Bible Belt thing, which is hardcore.
Whew. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we do the same thing in the States, right? The middle of the country just vilifies New York and LA, right? Those are just the pits of hell. And
yeah.
So this, I think, is a good transition point then. So you started to talk about you had an illness and it was chronic, and that just, as you insightfully pointed out, isn't well accepted within a tradition that believes in automatic healing. So talk about that, and when did the doubts begin to start?
Yeah, so that would be the start. I mean, I was always a little bit, you know, had questions. So certain things didn't make sense from the beginning. The fall of Satan in heaven, you'd be like, why is he not liking it up there? You know, this is what we're all shooting for. Why is he having a problem with it? And I'd ask these questions nobody could ever answer. And I thought, okay, I'm just clearly, I just need to keep quiet and stuff. So, but through the illness, I maintained my faith. It was all, I kind of embraced the suffering, the suffering Christ and the thorn in my side. And, you know, you just spin it whichever way you need to, don't you, to survive. Yes. I really do think I would have done better if I hadn't had a faith at that period in time. I worked, so I had secular friends, and they were, you know, they put no pressure on me to be healed or change or anything. Whereas the Christian ones, they, you know, earnestly prayed and casting this, that, and the other out, and laying on of hands and all that business. And I mean, all sorts of things, you know, generational spirits, you go through the whole thing. It's exhausting in itself, never mind if you've got chronic fatigue. Right. But after a little while, they tend to kind of move away because you're a bit of a difficult case and you've got too many difficult questions and they don't know how to handle you. So there was nobody really that mature who could handle the situation. So I just kind of lived with my doubts and didn't worry about it too much. And then what happened? We moved to France. So my husband and I now live in the Alps in France, which is fantastic. And I've made a totally full recovery. I definitely recommend it for lockdown, that's for sure. You've got sunshine and views and little mountain pass you can trundle under and, you know, remain in curfew. But
still sounds beautiful. Yes.
Yeah, it's lovely. So, and so I started reattending a little local church run by some Brits in the capital of the Alps, Chamonix. And I always just used to walk away feeling, I know I'm not doing enough. I'm not reading the Bible enough. I'm not praying enough. Mm. I'm not doing this enough. And you know, you're not supposed to have this guilt, but you do, because every sermon's about doing more.
Right.
About loving more, doing this. And you just, you know, I've got a quite healthy sense of self and self-esteem, but I still feel lousy when I come away from these places. So, and they always want to get you involved in loads of things that I was had no interest in. So I just stopped going. I think I got, also with the illness, I had got to a period when I just was like, okay, I can only say the Lord's Prayer and that's about it. I'm done. I just can't. It's too many questions. There's too much going on. And one day I remember thinking, oh, then with the advent of the internet, I started Googling a few questions about Adam and Eve and how their children procreated and all the usual kind of questions you've got.
The obvious questions that just leap out.
And then I think it was one weird day where I must have Googled something and exchristians.net came up. And I thought, sorry, but these are unicorns. These people don't exist. There's no such thing as an ex-Christian. You've got your backsliders and people who want to sin and reject Jesus, but you don't have ex-Christians who are really genuine. They're clearly not real Christians, was my first reaction. Right. So I thought, well, I'll have a little nose, let's have a look. And I was absolutely floored. I had no idea these people had the same doubts as me, that they were expressing the same, all these, and like these deep dark doubts and even ones I hadn't thought of and new ones. Like, oh no. Yeah. And they were missionaries and ex-nuns and theology students and devout believers who'd, you know, really tried to keep their faith but had lost it. So I just remember bewilderment, just thinking this is people who've really tried to preserve it. It's not about disobedience. It's not about short-term earthly gain. They know that we're talking about, you know, because that's what I just thought people were, as you giving up eternal life for a bit of pleasure down on earth. And so, and then they were saying that they were atheists, which basically for me was devil worship.
That's right.
It's just no other word for it, is there? So
baby eating, having horns, the whole thing.
Definitely. So in league with Satan, definitely. And but they seem to know their Bible a bit better than I did. So I did what everybody does, which is you try and shore up your faith, don't you? You go on a bit of a quest. I was like, okay, I'll need to devour information. So I was looking into evolution, cosmology, anthropology, neuroscience, you know, ancient religion, psychology of belief, mystical experiences. I listened to lots and lots of deconversion stories. And, you know, I remember the sort of slightly euphoric, exhilarating moments of discovering Hitchens and Harris and their irreverence and boldness. I was just, you know, left me kind of wide-eyed with my hand over my mouth, and finding people like Barker and John Loftus and Ryan Bell, or, you know, lots of, Bart Campolo was, you know, a fairly significant one as well. So
if you had ties to his dad's ministry, that would be really powerful to run across Bart. Bart is an amazing, he does amazing work. So
he does, and he's, and his dad, so does his dad, to be fair.
True,
He used to serve the people of Philly, and I had a fantastic time in the States with kids in the project and the suburbs of Philly and things. And it was a brilliant experience. So, and I converted a few, so I felt good about that. And It was 6 or 7. They didn't stand a chance.
yes.
And then, so I kind of dove a bit into apologetics, which I didn't even know was a thing. You know, I had no idea that these, I just thought all these difficult verses that I'd classed under difficult, I suddenly started becoming, you know, really interested in it and what it meant. So there's a podcast in the UK, I don't know if you're familiar with it, called Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio. I have to say they do a fantastic job of showcasing, you know, the two sides to a story. It's a really good quality podcast. Yeah, I really went forensic.
Yeah.
I worked through their entire back catalogue and listened to all these stories. And I just kept thinking, right, I'm going to get the answer this week. You know, the God of the Old Testament, why is he such a crazy loon killing everyone? And I'm like, right, great, this is it. The theist is pitched against a, you know, a scholar from the other side of view. And I just remember feeling, oh, they're not really winning this, are they? They're just not. Yeah, it just was really unsettling.
So I think we discussed this on the Skeptics and Seekers, but we've had this rash of very high-profile deconversions of basically celebrities in the Christian world that have deconverted or deconstructed in one way or another. And one of the things I often hear from apologists responding to that is, besides the obvious, you know, they were never real Christians thing, the second thing they often say is, well, they had a shallow faith. They didn't really study, or they didn't study apologetics. And I just want to point out, Sarah, that you just telling your story there, you literally were doing forensics, right? You were studying, you rattled off, you know, 10 different fields of study that you were investigating. And so the other thing that you say that's very, very common is this impetus to double down, to, you know, to pray more, to read the Bible more, to do these things. So any believers that are listening, right, Sarah did the work. Cannot accuse Sarah of not doing the work. The conclusions that she's about to describe are based on educating herself, not out of ignorance. And I just wanted to highlight that part.
Yeah, it just wasn't one issue. It wasn't just, oh, you know, a literal Adam and Eve, you know, kind of view. I did look into those things in that, and I assumed Adam and Eve were a literal thing initially. And then I found, obviously, you can see it allegorically in different ways. So I was like, okay, that's fine. I can deal with that. The Bible isn't inerrant. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Always inerrant, you know, has mistakes. I could live with that. Some people said some useful things there. So it's just slowly, slowly eroding. To some extent, it is a bit like being skinned alive. You know, your layers of belief are being pulled away. And
that's a great analogy. Without,
Okay. It's not a pleasant process. I wouldn't recommend it, which is why I don't try and hope anybody does go through it, because it's, you know, it's not without horror and kicking and screaming that you get pulled away. You literally are dying by a thousand paper cuts. That's the way.
Yeah.
And you're giving, you know, God CPR as much as you can to try and, because he's collapsed on you. So you really are trying to keep it alive for as long as you can with the best intentions. That's the thing. I think that as long as people really understand that that's the way many people that they try with the best intentions to keep their faith, and they don't. That was, I literally had no idea people like that could exist.
Your analogy was quite graphic of losing layers of skin, but what were kind of the pillars for you that you mentioned that you were able to handle, you know, a handful of things going away and letting go of those, but what were the things that were foundational bits that were the breaking the camel's back, so to speak? What is it that led to that?
Yeah, so I'd say obviously the big one, suffering. That's not exactly, I'm not exactly unique or particularly, different in finding that. Things like the fall of Satan, the whole idea of Satan, you know, I mean, God's already invisible. And now you've also got to make an invisible enemy as well. And when we've created that, and I couldn't really see any, I mean, he seemed to have a whole lot more power than God on the earth.
Yes.
So the fall of man, couldn't get my head around that one either. Didn't see that there was any evidence for a fall once man walked the earth. So, you know, animals have been suffering for decades, millennia before we have ever got here. So you go into all the, whether it can be a retrospective action, all that stuff. But mostly the Gospels, how they were written, who wrote them, things like the prophecies that turns out aren't really how the Jews view those texts at all.
Right.
The infighting over doctrine. I mean, you just take your pick, isn't it? It's like the one way and the only way. I mean, really, you've got Arminian, Calvinism, Protestants, Catholics, cessationists, charismatics. I mean, they literally are calling each other, the other side, liars, because
yes.
if you believe the gifts of the Holy Spirits have ceased, what are you making of the guy who's got his, you know, jabbering in tongues next to you? Because right. He thinks completely the opposite. Then you get more and more nuance, don't you? Is it a literal or a figurative resurrection? Is hell or universalism and Jesus' deity? When exactly did that happen? How did that happen? In what way did they think he was a deity?
Right.
Inerrancy, errancies. And today we'd have things like LGBT issues. You know, I mean, they seem to be finding a whole load of verses that support their view. And yet, obviously, those who still think homosexuality is a sin have got other viewpoints on it. So it's so different that they can't both be right. Or there's too much of an umbrella of views on it. So the other thing was that non-resistant unbelievers, that was a big one for me. People who genuinely want to believe, like I remember just being floored by a friend who said, oh, really? You believe this, do you? I'd really like to believe that. And I just remember thinking, well, how does that work? Just pray and ask Jesus into your heart and then it works, sort of thing. Yeah. And just finding people who'd really studied and had found it lacking and not,
right.
But yeah, all the historical evidence, you know, did the whole Barton and listened to lots and lots of lectures between them and people like Mike Nakona and stuff like that. So,
right.
And you go along the progressive route, don't you? You kind of keep edging it up until you become a universalist and kind of just start becoming a little bit more.
I wanted to refer back actually to, again, our conversation with Skeptics and Seekers. We were talking about, would a more liberal version of Christianity, being more progressive, have kept us in? And I was the one saying at some point it doesn't. Like, I definitely liberalized. I definitely became more progressive in very similar ways to what you are describing. But there comes some fall off point. There's some cliff that we come to where it's just one too many things.
Yeah.
And you have maybe a moment, maybe, you know, a week or a year of, you know, recognizing, I just don't believe the way I used to. What was that like for you? Was there a moment? Was it just a gradual realization? Was there a day that you admitted to yourself that you no longer believe?
It was gradual over several months where I started learning about the Gospels and thinking, oh my, this isn't good enough. This is not good enough, frankly.
Yeah.
Really, has God played so fast and loose with the evidence? He hasn't bothered preserving the originals. He didn't get Jesus to write anything down. We're still debating things like we are saved because of the faithfulness of Christ or because of the faithfulness in Christ. Now the repercussions of just that one Greek little verb word that they can't decide is enormous. You know,
yes.
If you're saved because of God, because of the faithfulness of Jesus, i.e. he carried out what he was supposed to, then we're all saved and we can all go home and just carry on with our life, be quite happy about it. Or if it's because you believe in Christ, then yeah, you have to have the whole born again experience and that kind of side of things. So it was that. I think it was ultimately, I just thought, what difference does it really make? I can't see it. I can't see what difference it makes to in the day to day. I've prayed for character traits that are, you know, I'd like to have more Christ-like or whatever. And,
right.
And they're not changing. And I'm just seeing normal things like becoming an adult or life experiences,
yes.
You know,
yes.
Honing those things, not necessarily being, there's no difference in it. What's almost, why bother? So I just thought, okay, there's enough doubt about this. I'm just going to stop. I'm going to stop praying. I'm going to stop. Yeah, I'm just going to stop. And nothing happened. Literally,
right.
I was astounded how I didn't feel this empty hole that I didn't. I mean, initially you have your little habits that you go back to pray when something,
yes.
When you're trying to find a parking space, oh, please go. And you're like, no, I will not go there. I'm going to just find my own parking space. And things just worked out anyway. So I was like, okay.
Right.
And what was also really disconcerting was that I would have these doubts and things, and I would start and I was looking around, and then there's just these texts or YouTube videos or people I'd come across that would just, the stuff would just resonate amazingly, a bit like the Christian experience sometimes when you read the Bible and it kind of speaks to you, as it were.
Right.
And I was just finding this was happening on the secular side for secular views and stuff. And I was like,
that's fascinating.
Yeah. And that was really, really weird, because I was just like, well, this isn't supposed to just feed me. You know, it was like it was nurturing me and feeding me and making me grow. And it was all good things were coming from it. And I was, and yeah, you discover philosophers and cosmology arguments and things that just made you just think, wow, I'm seeing the world in such a different way. And it's really exciting and interesting and positive. And so, yeah, that was a big one. So ultimately, I think I realized that I think you can be a quite a thoughtful Christian and, you know, have done your research and, you know, clearly yeah. people like Mike Lacona, who is a scholar, is not a stupid guy. He's done his, you know, knows his Bible. And
there are very, very intelligent apologists and theologians, somebody like yeah. Katinga, you know, these are very, very bright people. I often point out this has nothing to do with intelligence.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because you were the same intelligence when you believed, and you're the same intelligence now. And the same thing for the believers who are out there who are arguing for the faith, right? That it's not that they're not bright. It's not that they haven't done their own research. I think you mentioned something earlier. It's that the story makes sense when you're inside. When you're inside that bubble, it resonates, and it is very, very hard to look outside of that bubble and to see what mm-hmm. it looks like from a different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah, totally different. Yeah. I never thought I'd be outside the bubble.
Yes.
It was a total mistake. It's like, let me back in. I just want to, and I think to some extent it's so entrenched. I found it quite, yeah, I would say, but do I not believe it? I don't even know anymore, really. It's just, then I'd reread all the stuff I'd discovered and thought, no, hang on a minute, it is a bit far-fetched. But yeah. I have respect for somebody who's thought it through and has come down to that conclusion. I think you can go there. If maybe you were a bit more progressive from the start and some of the things you discover aren't so shocking, maybe you can land there. But you can also land on the other side. And just given that fact, just given that you yeah. can land either way, to me is the thing that clinches it for, well, it can't be down to belief. It can't be that whether you believe in the traditional kind of Protestant way that really is important. If God is there, he's not that bothered about it because he's letting you fall either side without too much difficulty.
Yeah.
So that was really what swung it for me. It's the thing that tips it. I'd say, you know, 50% one side, 50% the other. But the very fact that you can have this 50-50 is what makes it for me, it tips it in the yeah. favor of it can't be true, not in the way that it's being presented in terms of evangelical Christianity, right. where you have to believe a certain set of propositions. I mean, I always say I've deconverted from fundamental evangelical Christianity. That I can't believe anymore. I don't believe you have to say a sinner's prayer and that you're going to go to heaven or hell, that kind of thing. And no, it's just, but whether there's a God or something behind the creation of the universe, I don't know. I'm going to tell you now, I'm not going to be the one who works it out. I'm not yeah. that bright. It's not going to happen. It's just, there's people who have been pondering this for years. You can't yes. prove or disprove God. It's just like, it's pointless. And it's not up to me to work it out. I can say I don't know, and that's fine. Nowadays, I hold to a maybe there's, who knows, some sort of, they keep going down, don't they, fundamental particles and quantum physics and stuff right. like that. And now they're talking about maybe there's some sort of a force that we're not aware of, some sort of consciousness force. I'm not anthropologizing it.
Panpsychism is the new hotness right now.
Yeah, panpsychism. Exactly, idealism, that sort of thing, where maybe consciousness was at the root of it all in some sort of force, a bit like, if you're aware of Mike Mahaghi, the science yeah. Mike,
yes.
he lost his faith, and then he's kind of gravitated towards Christianity, but he sort of defines God, his first axiom that he had when he started back his reconstruction was that God was at the very least the forces that created and held the universe together. Yeah, that's kind of okay. It's a bit meaningless in some respects, but maybe, who knows? Yeah, whatever, maybe. And so I'm like a panpsychist on a Monday and a weekdayist on a Tuesday, yeah. agnostic on a Thursday. And well, maybe Christianity could be a useful fiction for creating myth and transmitting
right.
ideas that a bit a la Jordan Peterson as well, who does that kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, God is we act as if God exists, and you know, the ancient stories have kind of being rooted in our culture, and they're quite useful as myths to carry on. And so, you know, you can be a bit vague like that, a little bit more mystic-y. and I think, yeah, and then other days I'm just a hard naturalist. It's just, there's nothing more than just this material world and that's it. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know is a really intellectually honest place to be.
Yeah.
I think, you know, so much of the argument is between people who are not admitting how ignorant they are, right? You have to begin with, my ignorance is vast and comprehensive. And what I do very understand is a very tiny corner of the universe that is minuscule. And it's that curiosity then to go and seek answers that I think is really part of the purpose post deconstruction, deconversion, is to acknowledge one's ignorance and to go and seek more information, right? You may not find the ultimate answer to the universe, but you will become a fuller human being by studying all those fields of study that you rattled off earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's the journey, isn't it? It's just being in, there's no end point anymore. There's no kind of, I've got an agenda on it anymore. I don't know. I don't know that you can know. I don't think you can. People have tried, haven't they? And so, there's been different views and dualistic and Molinistic views and all sorts of things. So it's like, I don't know. I can't know. I'm not going to be. Yeah. So that's really where I'm at. And who says I have to go and work it all out? Who's defining this? So in a way, if I believe in God in any sense, I think he's bigger than all of that. It would be something even wider in the sense that it's this, it's almost consciousness and exploring and being and experiencing. And it's just that. And it's great. It's a great way to view life. I haven't missed the fundamental evangelical worldview one bit at all. I didn't expect to have there to be an upside. But definitely you know, all the exhausting issues kind of leave you. You don't have to worry and weigh up about the LGBT issues. You just go, okay, they're people. That's it. End of.
Is it a person? Yes, I can care about them.
There's nothing more to it. It's very freeing, which again, I don't think Christians want to hear, but it is. And it's not freeing like you want to go out and murder a load of people and sin, but it's just freeing in the sense you can. It's pretty simple, isn't it? Is love is a good way to live your life, and love is the point, and we've only got this present moment. That's all we know we for certain that we have. So whether there's an afterlife, whether consciousness does or doesn't continue, I don't know. All we have, all we can be responsible for is right now. So and just the finiteness of life, though, that was the biggest thing, thinking that I was, you know, from age 2 I thought I was going to live forever. And so there's no urgency to do stuff. There's no, you don't grab the opportunities that you maybe should, because you think, well, what's the point anyway? It's only a couple of years here, and then I'm up in heaven, and that's what it's all about. So I do think it robbed me a lot of experiences, and it needn't have done. I don't think all people who have faith need to view it like that, but I really did have this sense of, oh, I've got forever, so no problem. But now I'm much more like, wow, I need to make the opportunities count and really savor life in every way. And so it's richer. Yeah. It's all richer for it.
That's been my experience as well, of just the poignancy of my time with my daughters as they grow up, my time with my wife, my friends, my colleagues, like just a sense of this time is precious, and what I do with it counts.
Yeah. Yeah. But not in an objective sense.
Not in an objective way.
It matters not once we're dead, but you know, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. I just, but it's been so fascinating to hear about, you know, whereas just thinking you've only got the one right religion, and it's now really interesting to see the different viewpoints, Buddhism and, you know, these ideas of reincarnation. Think, you know, why not? They viewed things so differently. Whereas instead of you just assuming they're all inspired by the devil himself.
Right.
It just takes away those in-out group fightings anyway, and you're just open to all these new experiences and people, and it's really rich and rewarding this way to. So in a way, would we have had that if we hadn't deconverted? Because you wouldn't know you had a narrow viewpoint.
Exactly.
Until. So in a way, maybe it gave us a gift. I don't know.
I definitely think so. I do want to segue here really quick. I don't want to let you go before asking one of the the topics that comes up often on the show is people who have gone through some kind of deconstruction or deconversion and their significant other has not. It sounds like your husband did. Can you describe what that process was like? Were you communicating with each other from the get-go, or did one of you come out one day and say, "I don't think I believe anymore"? What was that like for you?
So he had an easier time of it in the sense of he was just like, we don't have to go to church. Oh, that's awful. I'm done. So yeah, he could, a lot of people would say, no, I mean, he was a Christian and believed it all as well in the same way as I did. I mean, it wasn't, we didn't even need to exercise faith. It just was the way the world was set up. There was no, so yeah, he believed it as well, but he's never really jived with the church thing either much. Prefers to be out in nature and skiing and biking and things like that. So not interested in sermons and things like that and reading the Bible. And he converted later at 13, so it's a lot easier to let go of the whole hell thing. So I would say, oh, I've just discovered, you know, we don't know who wrote the Gospels and half the letters of Paul are not written by Paul. And, you know, we haven't got the original copies and there's so many different variations. And he'd be like, oh, right, okay, okay. And then what he'd be occasionally be like, what is it we believe in? Because he was just, yeah, he's just not interested. He's not, he just doesn't find that so interesting. So, yeah, he was pretty, he just was like, okay, no, that makes a lot more sense now you say it this way. And oh, and he just started seeing the benefits of not it being caught up in that mind view. So for him, it was a fairly painless, easy process. And occasionally when I'm going through a little bit of being, I wouldn't say sentimental, but maybe theistic leanings, let's say, no more than that. But you're kind of like, oh, well, you know, maybe the story of Adam and Eve and our evil kind of nature, or just that we're a bit, something is broken in the world, you know, there is pain and suffering and there is people who do terrible things. And he's just like, cut to the chase. Do we need to go back? Are we going back to church? No, we're not. We're okay. Oh, that's all right then. So fortunately he did follow me out, because yeah, which if his parents ever hear this podcast, we'll do a downward.
It's all your fault, Sarah.
Exactly. I've led him into the jaws of death. No, he's much happier that way as well. Yeah, we're both just, we're slowly telling a few people here and there. And but I think the main thing with my thing was it was really lonely, because I wasn't in church. Can't talk to Christians because they will give you the standard apologetic stuff. My non-Christian friends just wouldn't have understood. They're like, I didn't even know you were a Christian. Why do you believe? Why really? You believed in the hell? Why just no, don't. So they don't understand. It really is this weird period of time where you're kind of on your own, because it seems to be different things that trigger it for different people. On the skeptics and seekers, talking to Matt, you know, the young earth creationism was really a big deal for him, whereas for me it didn't really figure too much. And for other people it will be a really bad experience in church, which again for me, I suppose I'd seen churches fall apart. I knew that man was fallible, but that didn't, you know, necessarily mean that God had anything to do with it. But so I was able to separate out the two. But it does seem to be a variety of things that just tip it for somebody. For Bart Ehrman, it was suffering.
I think that's really insightful. And I think probably the reverse is also true. The things that bring people into a faith, maybe beyond indoctrination as a child, will be different things. And so the things that bring you out of faith will be something different for everyone. I say that every deconversion story is unique, but they often rhyme. I mentioned several times in this episode, the commonalities of doubling down and doing research and all of those things like that is a pretty common thread through a lot of deconversion story.
Well, for anybody who for whom it meant a reasonable amount, I mean, yeah, as you say, there are nominal Christians that are just like, okay, yeah, no, I've grown out of this, bye. But yeah, no, I was a very actually, I just wanted to say that on the, because there's so many podcasts that sort of deal with people once they're kind of almost through it. I'd say I'm still on a journey of sorts, you know. But there is definitely a period of time where you don't even know where your camp is or where you may fall in the end, where you may still remain theistic in viewpoint. You may be kind of like a John Shelby Spong or a Mike Mahagy who can sort of hold those tensions and be okay with it. I think that's fine, but there is that period where you don't know where you are, and it is really hard because nobody gets you. And as soon as you want to talk to people who are deconverting, usually it's when they've deconverted, because they are right. a bit more sure of their view. So they're on the forums and the discussion groups and on the podcasts, and they're sort of talking about their experience, looking at it in the rear view mirror a little bit. Whereas right. when you're really going through it at the beginning, it's, and how can anybody kind of help you in that? Because they generally will fall one side or the other. So yeah. you'll have the Christians trying to get you back to believing, and, you know, recommending you read some more William Lane Craig or something. And yeah. oh, no.
And just like you said, as when you were still a believer, these were unicorns, ex-Christians. Yeah. So if you're in the early stages of this, you yeah. don't even know that it exists out there yet.
No. And you fear them. You just think they right. will make you lose your faith. And I just think you have to, well, this is why I would really highly recommend the Unbelievable podcast if you're at that kind of totally middle road, don't know or have serious doubts, because I think they do lay out both sides and you'll find something resonates with you, and it may be the theistic side. So go for it, you know, it's fine. Or you may just find that no, the arguments aren't good enough. It does seem very arbitrary what jives with you and what doesn't. Mm. Which I find makes it improbable that there is a God behind it, because he would make it that everybody would eventually find the truth yeah. if they sought out for it. So that's what makes it unlikely. But
I often say that it's not that believers, but Christians we're talking about specifically, don't take it seriously. It's that they don't take it seriously enough, right? If you take the implication mm-hmm. of a fully theistic, all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing God, there would be evidence. Right? Like the evidence yeah. would be inescapable. And yeah. and that we have watered it down to such trivialities, in my mind, is another strong argument for why it's rational to have doubts, strong doubts in that.
If we, in the sense of what, how it operates in our life every day, our trivial.
Yes. So, meaning that, like you talked about, you know, wanting to have a transformational experience in your character. And that's that's what's written on the tin, right? That isn't what people experience, though. They experience what you describe, the natural maturing of a human being.
Yeah. Well, some people say they do. That's the thing. It's still, there's still enough stories circulating within the Christendom that, and everyone's speaking Christianese in there, that, you know, they're sort of, oh, yeah, God really spoke to me, and I've really felt this burden shift, and, you know, especially in the charismatic movement. In fact, I was listening to a podcast, Secular Counseling. It was just listening in on sessions of counseling, and this the counselor was just saying, oh, I've really seen you're just said this to you, and it's really shifted something in you, you know, it's lifted your I can see a burden and unburdening. Now we would have totally framed that God lift coming in and healing you and lifting things off you, and that's the sort of language we spoke, and that's how we saw things. So but then you realize they happen in secular settings as well,
right?
And they're not necessarily particularly supernatural, they're just what happens when two humans communicate and one's trained in it and can maybe see things and pinpoint things for you that are really poignant. And I think that's the thing where Christianity maybe can keep the myth alive, as it were, that it's really doing a big difference, because you are taking the time to talk to people and have community with them and maybe pray with them. That's a very weird thing to pray for someone, isn't it? Sort of talking through their problems and hoping that works, and you might say something that's really helpful to them at that moment, so their countenance and everything might change and might get a bit more happy. And, you know, and you can easily interpret that as the Holy Spirit sort of wafting over the person. So and I think that was another thing. I watched a lot of Derren Brown. Are you
I'm familiar, but let the listeners know who that is.
He's this kind of mentalist illusionist in the UK, and definitely recommend some of his shows, because he's just fantastic showman on those types of magic things. It's all kind of mental games that he plays with people, so he gets people to do some incredible things, you know, hold up banks and all sorts of things. But he did a show called Miracles, where, you know, if you'd been in a charismatic setting, it would make for some pretty awkward watching, because it's so similar to a charismatic setting. And he literally gets these whole audiences to keel over, to suddenly be healed of all manner of things. And he just says, you know, absolutely nothing of that I'm doing. It's just I'm changing the story that people are telling in their head. So sometimes they will experience, they've always thought they had a, you know, an arm that wouldn't quite stretch out, but because I've planted the idea that they can stretch it out, suddenly they can, and they hadn't tried it for, you know, and he's just sort of explains how he does it. And you think, wow, this is really quite similar to the healing service. And that's why there's some good healers that can do it, because they've got those ingredients that helps to kind of manipulate the crowd in some respects. So without being too rude to these poor people, but
I heard Darren interviewed, I think it was the Center for Inquiry podcast, and he was saying he still has people write him months after that miracles performance and say, I'm still healed. There's very much something about the placebo effect and you know, putting something in someone's mind that does have some effect. And so that's what is happening in a charismatic environment, is that the placebo effect is in play and people do get better, but it isn't necessarily a supernatural event.
No. And same with prayer, when you're kind of just spending time thinking or meditating, you know, in the secular version of sort of mindfulness, I think they can have the same. It literally rewires your brain. It literally makes you conscious of some of your actions, how your thought patterns are going. So there's a lot of similarities that you can achieve in other ways. And I think that's why I just came to the, well, it's not that impressive then, really, is it, this claim? What is it we're all supposed to be getting excited about? I don't really know. It's in the dark times, Jesus doesn't come and comfort you. So what good is it when you're suffering? Because people were like, well, you know, he's suffering with us. What do you mean he's suffering with me? He had a rough weekend, you know, on earth. He had a bad time. I'm sure crucifixion isn't a walk in the park, but you know, he knew he was going to get his life back. It's not, what do you mean he's suffering with me? You know, it didn't make any difference. I couldn't discern it. So when I stopped, I didn't feel this great big hole, as it were, that you're told it all non-believers have, that they've got this aching hole for God, and that they are, you know, they just want to know that they're loved by him. And I think if you're maybe going through a really hard time and I don't know, got low self-esteem or something, that could be a great message, and you might convert and get a rush of emotions. Yeah. But I think that all of it can be explained that way. I mean, obviously there's some things that aren't explainable. There are weird, miracle-y type claims in the world that maybe we haven't got answers for, but a lot of them are kind of hyped up.
So one last topic that I wanted to talk about is the sense of community post deconstruction. We did the podcast together, and I was fascinated in that after we hit the stop button on the record, you and David and I chatted for another 15 minutes or so. And there's just such a esprit de corps between people who have gone through this. Again, you very insightfully pointed out that it's unique. It's not the same for people who have been secular all their lives. We have had the experience of being fully convinced, fully believers, and then having that cease to be. And there's something very unique about that, and something that bonds us together. I understand that you participate a lot in the Seekers and Skeptics podcast and on the Unbelievable boards, but can you describe your experience of the community that you've been a part of since deconstruction?
I mean, David was one of the people I kind of latched onto about 5 years ago. I noticed some of his posts on the forums, and they seemed really insightful, and he's just got a fantastic way of writing. So I'd recommend anybody. He's goes by the DJ and Danjab13, something like that.
We can put it in the show notes, and I'm going to be interviewing David shortly, so he'll be on the show.
Yeah, so what he didn't know didn't seem to be worth knowing. So I kind of latched onto him, and it was my guilty pleasure every Saturday morning to go for a run and listen to the podcast and then go straight back and see what David had written about the show on Unbelievable, because he'd give a good critique. And I have to say, some of his stuff was super scathing and quite insightful. So I learned a huge amount of him and the other guys on there. And funnily enough, they're great people. They're really good. And we've got the odd Christian that pops in on the board as well, a couple of hardcore ones, but they seem to be pretty uptight about belief. And Premier actually had to close down the boards on their news sites and some of the other podcasts that they do. Yeah, because the Christian infighting was so vicious that they had to. And the only one that keeps running is the Unbelievable board, which is mostly ex-Christians and atheists and So it's been lovely to meet these guys. And I mean, I don't have anybody locally that I can talk this through with. So
Right.
in person, it's all only in fact, I've never really told my story like this to anyone apart from on. Well, I did write it out in David asked me to write it out as part of the book we did. I'm under a pseudonym called Sophie,
Yeah, can you
and
talk just briefly about that as well? So we had Matthew Taylor and Andrew Knight on as well,
yeah.
and but talk about the book that you all put together.
So the host of Unbelievable, Justin Brierley, who's a really great guy, he really does this fantastic program, and he wrote a book about why he's a Christian after 10 years of talking to atheists and stuff. So he wrote a book and about his main arguments for it. Good apologetics book, covers a lot of the main points. And then so David said, well, why don't we do a reply book? Now I was just at the state where I was, I don't really know if I. What I believe, I'm still on this
Right.
journey. I'm still really unsure of all this, so still am. And so he just asked me to write a few chapters of just personal experience and interspersed it with some of the other chapters that dealt with the counter apologetics to what Justin wrote. We did this over, the internet without ever really meeting or anything like that, only just
Right.
on Skype calls and things. So it might go bit beyond the book, and it's maybe if one person had written it, maybe would be more kind of targeted exactly at what was in the book. So we might go off a little bit off topic, but it was good fun, and I quite enjoyed it, and not and sort of look back on it and think, oh, actually, yeah, my views have pretty much settled. I seem to be very much agnostic on it all. I don't really
Yeah.
mind too much what's going on out there. Yeah, and so got to know each other a little bit like that. Locally for community, obviously it's more people who are into the mountains and skiers and things like that. But it's funny how I used to be so scared of being stoned to death in a school car, school playground for my belief, because that's what happened to Christians.
You're
But
right.
yeah, I was terrified, absolutely terrified. That's what I thought was
Oh.
going to happen if I ever told them. It's actually funny now that I kind of approach a subject with people and I like learning about what they think about. And I'm like, so what do you believe about what happens after death? And then they've sort of said, well, nothing. And you're like, really? But you surely you knew that there was a God and that he's going to. No, never thought that. So I'm having
Yeah.
conversations now that I should have had probably when I was 17, 18, 19
Right.
into uni and stuff with these people, and it's great. And coming out to them and saying, look, and I quite like it. You get a good reaction when you say, well, actually, I was part of a cult. We used to before we never used to say, like my husband and I would be like, where did you two meet? Oh, well, we've known each other for a long time. Whereas now we just say, we met in a cult. It's a
Yeah,
great conversation
it's a great
starter.
story.
So I wear the badge with pride, but no looking back for sure. Definitely not with evangelical Christianity. Don't
Yeah.
recommend it. It's not healthy for you.
Sarah, is there any place that people can find your work? Obviously the Still Unbelievable book, but do you want to point people
Yeah,
at?
that's on reasonpress.net, though you can find the book. I cut my stories over three chapters. Probably heard a lot of it tonight, to be honest. Didn't get to say the word cocaine of certainty, which is what I put in the book. I love that little phrase, where we were all addicted to the cocaine of certainty as Christians, where we're kind of like, we thought we knew it all. We had that certainty in the brain. It was all really, and it is a cocaine. It is something that makes you feel safe and secure. And that's why Christians are like, the Bible clearly says X, Y, Z. And they love lording it up like that. And I've let go of that cocaine certainty. I don't know anymore. So
Right.
anyway, yes, off topic. So I'm on there. You can probably see me on the Unbelievable boards as well. After each week, I've posted a little bit in the discussion things. And on Skeptic and Seekers, I think I've been on Still Unbelievable as well, which was with Matthew one time. So yeah, but Matthew, David, and Andrew kind of dip in and out of all of those. So
Right. Well, I think that's a really very cool community, and I've enjoyed being on the periphery of that.
oh, come on in.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Sarah, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. This has been an amazing interaction here. So, thank you so much for being on the
No
podcast.
problem.
Final thoughts on the episode. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Sarah as much as I did. I think her approach to communicating her story is unique and wonderful. She's very down to earth. It's very practical. It's very human in the way that she tells her story. And at the same time, recall that she mentioned almost 10 fields of study that she focused on during that process. So she did the homework. You can't accuse her of not studying and trying. On the way out, she was kicking and screaming, trying to stay in. She has a very evocative analogy of trying to put God on life support using CPR, trying to keep him alive in her life, and that utterly failing. She described the deconversion process as like being skinned alive, where layers of belief are pulled away. It's a death by a thousand paper cuts. I also really appreciated her intellectual honesty to say that she does not know. She's not sure about what the answers are, and she recognizes that humanity has been arguing over these questions for millennia. I think that's a really honest place to be, and I respect her for taking that stand. Finally, I'll leave you with one of her secular grace thoughts of the week. Love is a good way to live your life. Love is the point. And we only have this present moment. That is all we know for certain. Live your life with the point being love, and knowing that this present moment is all you know for certain. This point may be more poignant and even anxiety-inducing at this moment in time with COVID-19 and the real possibility of becoming sick yourself or someone you love becoming sick. Fortunately, the vast majority of us will probably get this and be just fine, but a non-trivial amount of us will have some tragedy, and I am so sorry for that. This is the time to show your love and care for the people who you are close to, family members, friends, colleagues even. Let the people around you know that you care for them. Let this be a moment, as Sarah says, to savor its richness, to recognize that we need each other, and to be the person who provides that human contact for others. I want to thank Sarah for being on the episode and for sharing her story in such a poignant way. Stay safe out there, stay healthy, and until next week, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for some footnotes. The song is a track called Waves by Micaiah Beats. Please check out her music. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to help support the podcast, here are the ways you can go about that. First, help promote it. The podcast's audience grows by word of mouth. If you found it useful or just entertaining, please pass it on to your friends and family. Post about it on social media so that others can find it. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This will help raise the visibility of our show. Join me on the podcast. Tell your story. Have you gone through a faith transition? You want to tell that to the world? Let me know and let's have you on. Do you know someone who needs to tell their story? Let them know. Do you have criticisms about atheism or humanism, but you're willing to have an honesty contest with me? Come on the show. If you have a book or a blog that you want to promote, I'd like to hear from you. Also, you can contribute technical support. If you are good at graphic design, sound engineering, or marketing, please let me know and I'll let you know how you can participate. And finally, financial support. There will be a link on the show notes to allow contributions which would help defray the cost of producing the show. If you want to get in touch with me, you can Google Graceful Atheist, or you can send email to gracefulatheist@gmail.com. You can tweet at me at gracefulatheist. Or you can just check out my website at gracefulatheist.wordpress.com. Get in touch and let me know if you appreciate the podcast. Well, this has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. Grab somebody you love and tell them how much they mean to you. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.